I want to ask you a question as we sort of start this morning. Have you ever looked at where you are in your life and just wondered kind of how you got there? Maybe felt like this isn't the life that you imagined yourself living. This isn't the story that you would have written for yourself. This is not what you thought would happen. This is not what you dreamed about or imagined. Maybe the job that you're in was only supposed to be a temporary position, and 20 years later, you're still there. Or maybe this move that you've done was only supposed to be for a short while, and you've never gone anywhere else. You find yourself battling things. You find yourself struggling with things that you thought you should be over by now. This battle you're fighting, you should have kicked a long time ago, yet it's still there. You find yourself living in a story that you didn't think you'd be in, and you want a new script, you want a new story, but you don't really know where to start. Maybe you feel stuck where you are. As I think about someone who may have felt that way, I think about David and David's story in the Old Testament. To understand David's story, you have to understand what happened before David, that Israel had always been a nation that had been ruled by God, and they followed God, and they had prophets, and they had judges, and they had people that sort of were spokesmen for God, but they never had a king. They never had an actual ruling monarch-type king, and that made them different, and that made them, some people within Israel, not like that. They wanted a king to be like other nations. And so God finally gave them what they thought they wanted, which was a king, and so he chose someone very tall, a Benjamite by the name of Saul, 6'9" by most historical estimates. And he was so brave and so courageous that at his own coronation and inauguration, they couldn't find him because he was hiding amongst the luggage. He was so scared of being king that he was hiding. And they had to drag him out and say, no, you're king, and put him in his position. But unfortunately, Saul was not a king. He was not a man after God's own heart. In fact, he listened to the opinions of men around him more than he listened to the clear directives of God. And in one particular case, he was told clearly by God to wipe out the Amalekites. And instead, he listened to those around him who said, you know what, there's a lot of cattle, there's a lot of wealth, there's some people that we could, you know, put into slavery, there's some resources here that we could take advantage of. Why would God have you wipe all of them out? And so Saul listened to his advisors and disobeyed God. And because of that, then Samuel the prophet came and said, because of this, God is rejecting you as king, Saul. And Samuel took out his sword and killed the Amalekite king. Well, in that moment then, God wanted to anoint a new king. And so he sent his prophet Samuel to a family that lived in Bethlehem. And the father's name was Jesse, and he had 7 sons. The youngest of these sons was named David. Now, in our culture now, I'm the youngest born. How many in this room are babies? Like the youngest. Okay, awesome. We've got pretty good lives. In fact, the older siblings feel like we've got it the best, right? Is that, how many older siblings, like oldest are in here, okay? How many of you think that the youngest had it easier than you growing up? Okay, there we go. And some of your moms and dads are in the room when you said that, so that's awesome. So you guys can work that out after. But yeah, you know, that's the classic story is that, you know, my sister, she got it hard. You know, she was listening to the radio. You know, like my parents gave her a radio and she was listening to a secular rock station and she recorded Mr. Mister. This is the 80s now, okay? And some of that, anyone remember? Okay, I won't keep making you raise your hands. It's one of those days. I keep making people raise their hands today. I don't know why. So she made a tape of Mr. Mister, you know, Broken Wings, I think, or one of those songs, or Kyrie Eleison, one of those classic 80s songs. Anyway, she made a tape. My dad found the tape, and her stereo just vanished forever. Like, I thought he just put it in some secret place, and it never appeared. He probably just returned it to the store. I don't know what happened, but, like, in my kid memory banks, it just vanished, never to be seen again. It was like a Christmas gift. So she was like, man, my sisters, they brought the iron fist. By the time I was kind of cruising through high school, not the same standards. You know, I would have CDs arrive from Columbia House and BMG Music. My parents were like, what are you listening to? I'm like, oh, this is, you know, LL Cool J, and they're like, oh, that's interesting, and like, no problem, you know, I'm not condoning that, I'm just saying, by the time it came to me, they sort of had run out of energy, I think, in a lot of ways, and just kind of, he'll be fine, I think. So now, you know, the baby of the family is kind of like, in our time, is kind of the one who maybe gets spoiled a little bit, or maybe a little bit cruises through some of the discipline. But you have to understand, at this time, when you were the youngest of seven, it wasn't the same story. You were not the heralded, most loved and beloved. You were, in fact, the least of the seven. The eldest two were the most important in the family, especially among sons. So the way it worked was, the father would have, you know, the inheritance would be, you know, land, and it would be, you know, crops and cattle and sort of agricultural inheritance. And the oldest son would get a double portion, or 66% of his dad's total estate. And then the second son would get 33%, and the rest would get zilch. So if you were the seventh son, you didn't have much to look forward to family-wise as far as financially or any other way. And so David, when we meet David, is doing exactly what a seventh son would be doing, which is watching his brother's sheep. He was a shepherd. In fact, his future was probably best described as a hireling. He would be someone who would just bounce from pasture to pasture, a shepherd for hire. Someone that Jesus described later as not the good shepherd, but a hireling was someone who's like, hey man, I'm not dying for those sheep. If a wolf comes, I'm out, because I'll just find another pasture to get in. This is fine. This is not worth dying for. So David was on a fast track to be that kind of a hireling with his life. But David was different. David could have chosen to be that sort of laid back, just sort of, who cares what happens to my brother's flocks or my dad's flocks? I've got no vested interest in this. And instead, we find out that while David was watching those sheep, he was writing poetry. He was writing music. He was practicing his musical instruments. In fact, he even defended his brother's future inheritance from a lion and a bear, which it said in the text that he grabbed and killed when they tried to attack the sheep. So he was actually a good shepherd. So Samuel comes to Jesse's family. Samuel the prophet comes to Jesse and is going to anoint one of his sons to be king. And so Jesse, knowing this, gathers his first six sons together for Samuel to choose from, to see which one he wants. And each one Samuel would stand in front of and say, surely, Lord, this is the one. He's strong and he's tall and he's, you know, looks very brave and he's a warrior. And God would say, nope, that's not the one. Nope, that's not the one. Nope, that's not the one. And goes all the way down the line of six, to the point where Samuel's kind of like, well, God, I don't see any others. And, you know, these guys look so impressive. And then is spoken those words that we cling to so tightly. For man looks at the outside, but God looks at the heart. And so Jesse thought so highly of his seventh son that he didn't even invite him to the lineup of possible future kings, which is amazing to me. That's how little he was thought of, that they had to go fetch him from the sheep to bring him back, stand him in front of the prophet, and in that moment God says, this is the one. So he's anointed king in front of his brothers, and if there wasn't already family problems and rivalries and older brothers beating up the younger brothers, it was going to start in earnest now, because now he was anointed and they weren't. So there were some rivalries that were bound to happen. But from the moment that David was anointed the future king of Israel, Saul hadn't been deposed yet. Saul was still very much the king, even though God had said, I reject you. So from the time that David was anointed to be king, future king, until David was actually the king of all of unified Israel was about 15 years of time went by. Can you imagine waiting that long? But it wasn't like he just went to king preparatory school or something like that, where it's like, well, let's learn how to be royal, like every Disney movie about these princesses, you know, and all that stuff. No, there was no school like that for him to go to. In fact, once Saul figured out what was going on, Saul, the current king, then sought to kill David. So many of those years, David spent running from the present-day king who was actually hunting him and trying to kill him. So he's running for his life during this season. You talk about someone who, and the thing was that when Samuel anointed David, he didn't say, you are the future king, and in 15 years you shall rule and reign. He didn't say that. He just said, you are the future king. So he didn't know if it was going to be a year, 5 years, 10 years, 15, or 30 years. So he was just waiting and preparing and getting ready. Well, during this season of waiting, there were many people that came to David. In fact, there's a passage that talks about a cave of Adullam, where David was, and it said that people came to David who were mistreated, who were misfits, who were rebels, who were disenchanted with Saul as king, basically kind of like rabble, sort of like a revolutionary gathering of people that were just sort of dangerous criminals and others who just didn't want to be a part of Saul's kingdom but wanted to be a part of David's. Among them were some incredible soldiers. We look back and we remember them as the mighty men of David. And I want to tell a story about a moment in David's life when he's not yet king, but he's at the cave, and he's in a very interesting spot because he's at the cave of Adullam, and the Philistines, who were not big fans of David ever again after he went and killed their champion named Goliath as a young boy, David slayed their giant, and now they were encamped outside of the cave of Adullam in the valley of Rephaim. And they also had a garrison or a stronghold in Bethlehem, which was David's hometown. So talk about kind of an insult to injury. David's backed up into his cave. They're all surrounding him in this valley. And then in his hometown is where they've set up their headquarters. So this is a pretty intense moment. So if you want to turn with me in your Bibles to 2 Samuel 23, I just want to highlight kind of what happens here in this moment. I want to talk about these mighty men of David. 2 Samuel 23, verse 8. These are the names of the mighty men whom David had. Josheb Bashabeth, a Tekhemite, he was chief of the three. He wielded his spear against 800 whom he killed at one time. We just pause there for a moment. 800, a spear, one man, done. That's unbelievable. I mean, just from in the halls of mighty warriors, I mean, 800 with a spear. With a spear. And I mean, a spear, you know, there's the blade is at the end, and then you've got a long stick on there. So there's all kinds of crazy jujitsu going on here. I don't know how you do that. I mean, I've watched a lot of those wartime movies, and I still have yet to see one man destroy 800 like that. So this was the chief of the three of the mighty men of David. So he killed 800. Unbelievable. And next to him, verse 9, among the three mighty men was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the son of Ahohi. So thankfully, Dodo has kind of fallen off the list of approved names now for children. You don't see too many holding up their new baby and say, oh, he looks just like a Dodo. He's such a Dodo. But with a name like that, you would be a mighty warrior because he spent his whole life beating up people who made fun of his name, I think. So that's one way to toughen up your kid. Give him a name, like a boy named Sue or something. Okay. Son of Ahohi. He was with David when they defied the Philistines who were gathered there for battle, and the men of Israel withdrew. He rose and struck down the Philistines until his hand was weary and his hand clung to the sword. Other translations say his hand was frozen to the sword. And the Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the men returned after him only to strip the slain. So here's a story where he's in this field and he's defending it and everyone else leaves, but he strikes down so many Philistines that his hand is stuck to his sword. He cannot get rid of his sword. It's stuck to it. The only thing I can equate this to is like if I've been outside, do you say weed whacking or weed whipping here? Every area is different. All right, yes. It took me a while to get to the weed whipping. Michigan's all about weed whipping. I'm like, we're not whipping them, we're whacking them. Like they're ended. We don't want to like punish them. We want to kill them. Anyway, that's whatever. So if you hold that long enough, you got that trigger finger, you know, on it. Those of you that have weed whacked before and walking around, after doing that for a couple hours, you know, like I've had that moment where I'm like, I can't, my hand is frozen to the weed whacker. Now, it's not a very, I don't want you to write that about me. Like our pastor's such an incredible landscaping strong man that his hand froze to the weed whacker. But I've been there and I've had to like peel my hand off. So I know that the phenomenon is real, but his froze to a sword, which is a much cooler story to tell. But he killed so many that his hand was just a death grip, and he killed them all. So you have one killing 800, another one who killed so many that his hand froze to the sword, defending the fact that his last name was Dodo. And then you've got verse 11. And next to him was Shammah, the son of Agi the Harahite. The Philistines gathered together at Lehi, where there was a plot of ground full of lentils, and the men fled from the Philistines. But he took his stand in the midst of the plot and defended it and struck down the Philistines, and the Lord worked a great victory. So Shammah loved lentil soup, apparently, because everyone else was like, we're out of here. Keep the lentils. We're going. And he's like, not on my watch. they are not taking these lentils. And he defended the lentil field, and he won a great victory. And what I love is all the guys who ran away that were scared, they returned to strip the dead, you know, take the weapons away from those that were gone, and to maybe eat some lentils. Verse 13, so here's the story. So these are the three. These are incredible men. And three of the 30 chief men went down and came about harvest time to David at the cave of Adullam, when a band of Philistines was encamped in the valley of Rephaim. David was then in the stronghold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then at Bethlehem. And then David said longingly, "Oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem that is by the gate." So just for a moment here, remember, his hometown that he grew up in was full of Philistines. That was like their headquarters. You know, outside the valley was full of Philistines. He was backed up into this cave. You know, he's been on the run for years at this point. He's still not fully king. He's waiting and waiting, and he kind of had that moment where he's like, wow, if I could just get some of that water from my hometown. It was so good. I'm so sick of this cave water. If I could just get one more bottle of Bethlehem spring. That stuff is so cold and refreshing. It's kind of like anyone in here who's, you know, maybe been in the military, been overseas, and you just so long for your wife's cooking. Or maybe you're just, you know, you move far away and you can't wait to come back home and go to Rudy's on the lake and have something fried in whatever it's fried in. You just long for that kind of home-cooked stuff. Or you've had, you know, Angela's mom's apple pie and you're, apparently, the apple pie is what struck the chord strongest there. I'm like, man, the apple pie is the sound system rejects the apple pie, I think, or it likes Rudy's. But that thing where you just find yourself longing for something that you've had to do without, kind of like the longing of a soldier who's overseas. Oh, just to have one taste of home, I miss it, I need it, I long for it. But it's a daydream. No one expects someone to, you know, jump on a plane, fly home to Rudy's, and get the clam chowder and the Yankee plate, and bring it back over to you and serve it. It's not going to happen. But yet, in this moment, David shares longingly what he would love to drink in that moment. And look what happens in verse 16. Then the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines and drew water out of the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate and carried it and brought it to David. Let's just pause there. So here's the three mighty men. So most of the people that would have heard him say this would have probably done what you and I would have done, which is like, yeah, my goodness, that's good water. You know what I miss? I miss the falafels in Jerusalem. Or I miss my goodness, you know, I could deal with Mountain Dew out of a glass bottle, or you know, whatever it is that you're thinking. And then, but three of them heard it and looked at each other and were like, and this wasn't a short journey. This is 12.1 miles each way from the cave of Adullam into Bethlehem, which was heavily fortified at this point. So it's guarded, and this is near the gate. So the gate would have been where they had the harsh, you know, the most intense guarding. I just imagine being the Philistines for a moment. So these guys are like, let's go. They've got their swords. They've got their spears. They've got their large thermos or whatever they're bringing to get the water in. And they're coming over the hill and they're running. And the Philistines are like, okay, here they come. Someone's coming. Okay, let's get ready, men. Okay, I see three so far. There's three coming. Okay, there's got to be more. This has got to be Ruth. Check behind you. Check the mountains. Anyone else? No, there's nobody over there. There's no one over there. Okay, we just got the three so far, but keep your eyes on the hills because there's no way just three men are coming in the middle of the day to try to attack us. This makes no sense. Just keep your eye on them. Okay, what are they doing? What are they holding? Okay, one apparently has a small cup in his hand. I don't see what's happening here. Okay, and then they get to the line, and it says they break through the lines. So they're slashing and dashing and stabbing and pushing and knocking away. Imagine these guys are like, these are assassins. They're going for our general, or they're going to steal our plans, or they're going to steal something of value from us. And then they stop at the well, and they're just putting water in there. And they're like, who are these guys? Are they taking a water break in the middle of this battle? You know, one guy's stopping, the other ones are fighting them away because, of course, they're coming after them the whole time. And they get the water, and they cap it up, and then they leave. They fight their way back out, and they head off into the field. From the Philistine perspective, I think they might be a little bit confused. What just happened? I lost my leg for the water? what is going on? This doesn't make any sense. Who are these guys? Who's the? What kind of diabolic? Did they poison the water? Did they shoot something? Did they light something? Did they roll something in somewhere? Did they plant some, you know, did they bring some Ebola thing and leave it here? I don't know what's going on, but something else has got to be afoot. There's no way the mission was just to get some water. And so they return the 12 miles back, and they arrive to David. Now, sometimes on my way home from church or from wherever, you know, I'll stop off and get something for Angela, you know, like maybe a little thing of ice cream or something like that. And part of the joy for me is to kind of like surprise her with it and be like, oh, here it is, sweetie. I don't get down on one knee usually, although I should. I'm probably missing my moment there. But just hand it to her. Oh, my queen, here's your ice cream. And yeah, sounds great. Perfect. So I hand that off to her. But part of the joy is watching her enjoy it. You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing worse than giving it to her, and then she's like, oh, I'm not really, I'm good. Like, what do you mean you're good? I just stopped and bought it, and it was Walmart. I had to weave through there and deal with all that whole scene and, you know, get the ice cream and get out the door and, you know, like, just eat something. No, I'm good. And I'd be like, sweetie, can you just humor me and just try it, for goodness sakes? Like, I don't want to see you put it in the freezer and eat it tomorrow when I'm not here. We want to see the person sort of enjoy what we've given to them. So here's what happens. Verse 16, it says, they brought it to David, but he would not drink of it. He would not drink it. So he refused it. So they say, here, you know, my king, imagine just, I mean, everyone had to have seen this and gathered around, just in picture 400 plus people gathered around all in this cave as these guys are coming through. You know, everyone out of the way, out of the way. You know, they got this water and like, don't spill it now. You know, like, we got all the way here, for goodness sakes. And they get right to him, and it's they get down and, you know, here, our king, our now and future king, here's what you asked for. And just their face is just, oh, I can't wait to watch him drink it. It's so good. I stole a sip on my way back. No, I don't know. But it's got to be good if he wanted this. And David refused. It's amazing to me why he would refuse, though. I mean, you would think, what an insult to these guys. Why would you say that and then not take it in? Why wouldn't you say, of course, thank you, my goodness, I'm gonna sip it now, I'm gonna make some of the ice cubes so I can have some later. You know, I'm gonna take a little bit and just wash my hair. It's so clean, I'm gonna drink it. I cannot wait. Thank you for this water. But he would not drink of it. Instead, he poured it out to the Lord and said, far be it from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Shall I drink the blood of men who went at the risk of their lives? Therefore, he would not drink it. So it's amazing to me that in this moment, here you have David, in this moment, frustrated, stuck in this cave, longing for a taste of home. Not yet the king he was anointed to be. He was between the anointing and the coronation, between the anointing and the crowning. Stuck somewhere in the middle. And here these guys treat him like a king. They go and get him water and they risk their lives. And when they bring it to him, it reminds David that it's not about him. It reminds David that there's something so much bigger going on here than his thirst being satisfied by this water. That what they did, he is not worthy of that kind of sacrifice. That what they did is only worthy enough. Only God is worthy enough of that kind of sacrifice. It's almost like it took that moment to remind David that as frustrated and as stuck as he may have felt, ultimately his story is being crafted by God, and it's really about God's story. And in that moment, David could take that water and say, I'm going to take this story, which would have been a nice story to tell. If the story had ended with David just saying, cheers to all of you, thank you, take the sip and they all cheer, yay, that would still be a good story. But the fact that David took this water and said, there's only one who's worthy of this, and it's God. And he poured it out to God as an offering. That is not a waste. Some might look at that, maybe even the crowd, and be like, my goodness, what a waste. These men risked their lives to go get it. They brought it back at great cost, and he pours it out as an act of worship. That's an incredible waste. Think about Jesus in his life. Remember when that woman broke open the pure nard, that perfume that was worth an entire year's wages of a day laborer, $25,000 in today's currency. She took that, broke it open, and she wiped his hair with it, weeping and anointing him as king. And remember what people said around her, especially Judas? What a waste. What an incredible waste. That could have been sold and given to the poor. That water they risked for, you should have drank it to encourage the men. We should have taken the water and maybe, if you weren't going to drink it, keep it capped in its special BC thermos that we still had back then and carried around with us as a sign of our chivalry and our bravery and our boldness. We should have kept it. It's not a waste. It's not a waste to give our very best to God. It's not a waste to sacrifice for him. It's not a waste to give him something that cost us everything. But what I love about this story is that it shows David, it reminds David, even as he is stuck, even as he is waiting on God to make the rest of his story happen, even in that moment, David realized that it wasn't about David's story, it was about God's story. That God was inviting David into his story. And I struggle with this. I have to be totally honest with you. I struggle with this principle. Because so often I am so caught up in the details of my life and what God has created me to do and what I feel like God has called me to do and where I feel like I should be doing that and what my life should look like and what it shouldn't look like, that sometimes I need to be reminded that all the things that God's given to me, I need to pour out for him, because it really isn't about me, it's about him. That anything I'm able to do for him, for his glory, any leadership I'm able to be in, any talent, any gift, anything I have is not of me, it's of him. He's the one who gave it to me anyway, so I should be pouring it out before him. And frankly, when I have these realizations, I'm embarrassed. I wonder if David was almost embarrassed in this moment when he poured it out. Oh, I'm sorry guys, I can't touch it. How dare I even? I can't believe you did this for me. I'm not worthy of this. This is for you, God. This is for you. Pours it out. As I look back at my life, I realize so many moments that I have made it about my life and my story. That I've made it about where I think I should be. That I've made it about what I think I deserve or where I think I should be going. And yet there's a God who invites me into his story and wants me to engage at the highest possible level with where he has me. The stage of life he has me right now. I love that the three men could have chosen to just blow it off. But instead they heard the longing of their king and chose an epic story for themselves. And what's amazing is their act of heroism, their act of bravery and borderline stupidity became an act of worship for everyone else. Isn't that amazing? God can even take our moments of complete stupidity. Have you ever had someone look at you and be like, wait, that's great. Why were you there in the first place? Why did you talk to that person? Why did you take that trip? Why did you go? And you're like, what do you mean why? I mean, God did this great thing. But my goodness, like, what were you thinking when you did it? I don't know. I just thought that's what God wanted me to do. And God uses even our moments of a lack of judgment and things that we shouldn't have done maybe looking back, but God had a plan and God used it, and what was an act of heroism or bravery or stupidity somehow became for someone else an act of worship, where they saw that bravery, they saw that risk, and they saw God use it, and they look at your life and they're like, my goodness, that glorifies God, what you did. And that's how we write ourselves into God's bigger story. It's interesting because I think of those three men and I think about two. What if all three of them had different ideas of how to get the water and decided to all do it themselves. Now, they were pretty incredible guys, so maybe it would have worked out. But instead, we have a story of them working together, fighting for each other as they went and got the water and came back. Jesus tells a different story of three servants. It's in Matthew 25, verse 14, if you want to flip over there. In this story, you have three servants, and the master comes to them, and he's about ready to leave on a trip, and he goes up to them, and he says, okay, to each one of you, I'm going to give to you talents or finances, money. I'm going to give you resources, and I expect you to make something happen with them. So I'll read it to you here so that my paraphrase is not going to be as good as the actual text here. Verse 14 of Matthew 25. For it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted to them his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to the second 2 talents, and to the other 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went away. He who had received 5 talents went at once and traded with them, and he made 5 talents more. So also he who had the 2 talents made 2 talents more. But he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. And after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. Okay, so here's the story. So the master stands them up, 1, 2, 3. And he looks at the first one, and according to their ability. So imagine you're one of these servants, and you see the guy that's like you're kind of maybe rivals with. I don't know, but they look at you and they say, okay, here's 5 talents for you. That's a lot of money. I'm entrusting this to you, but I think you can handle it according to your ability. Okay, yes, thank you, master. And the next one, 2 talents. You know, here, I believe in you. I think you can manage it. I think you're going to do a great job. 2 talents. Okay, thank you, master. Yes. Third one, here's 1. 1 talent. Here's what I think you can handle. And the reactions are interesting because all three of them go out. The first one takes the 5, and he runs out and says he made 5 more. But think about it. How do you make money with money? The word would be investment, right? It's capitalism. It's entrepreneurialism. It's saying, okay, I'm going to invest, and I'm going to put in a little coffee stand. You know, if this was me, maybe this is what I would do. I don't know. Put a little coffee stand in the Agora Marketplace, and I've invested some of my money in that. And boy, maybe I'm going to buy into this guy because he's got the other coffee stand. I'm just going to buy them both, and then no one will know that I'm winning either way. You know, that's great monopoly. But so I'm there. But you know what? If people don't come and get my coffee, I'm paying employees. I've got materials, I've got supplies. I'm risking. To invest is to risk. Anyone in financial world knows this, that every investment has risk to it. So when they went and took the 5 talents out and invested it, they took the master's 5 talents, his property, his money, and they risked it, and they could have lost it all. And the same with the man who had 2. He took 2, and he invested it, and he risked it, and he was able to make some money. But the third one looks smart, doesn't he? Because if the third one, if he thinks it's a game, he's bet $1 on the Price is Right, hoping the other 2 bust. You know, so, well, I'll take mine, and I'm going to just bury it and put it in the ground and just wait for him to come back. And that way, when these 2 yahoos lose all their money, I'll have 1 left and I'll win. But that's not what happens. In fact, it says in the text the master was gone for a very long time. So imagine if that was his plan on week 1 and he was feeling good week 1, like, all right, here's the mound. I'm sitting on it. I'm near it. I'm going to win. This is so smart. Those guys are idiots. They're out there working so hard, risking. I know that he already lost money on that cart. He got taken for a ride. Nope, I'm winning. This is awesome. Week 2. Well, they're starting to make some money over there. I still like my plan. My plan's great. Week 3, week 4, week 5, week 6. Boy, if I dig it up now and start something, I still might, I don't know if I should do it. You know, you wonder how long his confidence remained in his plan, because the longer time went by, and then what happens? He didn't appreciate being given 1. He didn't want to engage what the master had asked him. He didn't want to take the 1 and go all in with what he had been given in that moment. He wanted to wait for him to come back and give him more. So you wonder if over time, as he felt stuck, as he felt ignored, as he felt undervalued, did he become bitter? Did he become resentful? Did he become angry at the master for being like, how dare he just give me 1? I'm smarter than both of those guys, and I'll prove it by winning this. What's interesting, though, there's a wrinkle. Is if you understand rabbinic law at that time, is that if someone entrusted property to you, like this exact scenario, and you took that property and buried it in a hole in the ground and didn't touch it, then you were not liable for it. If something happened to it, if it was stolen, if it was lost, it was not your responsibility. It was like rolling over someone's trust. Maybe you're the executor of someone's will and you're just getting money to where it needs to go, but you're not taxed on it. It's not your responsibility if something happens to it because you've just put it in the right places. So not only was he saying, I'm putting it in the ground because I don't want to do anything with it, he was saying, I don't want anything to do with you at all. He took the ultimate safe route by saying, I have no part of this. It's amazing, that attitude, because it's so easy for me to look at that man and say, my goodness, you know, why didn't he engage? Why didn't he just get into it and do it? My goodness, for me as an underdog, wouldn't you want to be like, I'm going to take my one talent and I'm going to show those other guys. I'm going to make this talent. I'm picturing some kind of a gold bar here. Sorry if you're not with me on whatever I'm holding up, but I'm going to take this gold bar and I'm going to make it bigger than all those guys. I'm going to build an empire and I'm going to show everyone. But instead, he chose to bury it and wait for something better. Instead of engaging with what the master had given for him to do right then, he wanted to wait. He didn't like what he had been given, so he was going to sit on it and wait till something else came his way. Now, it's really easy for me to take shots at that guy. But how often have I acted that way towards stages in my life where there's been a season where this is what God has given to me? This is what I've been entrusted with. And I've said, no, I don't want it. I'm waiting for this to resolve. I'm waiting for the other side. I'm waiting for the big payday. I'm waiting for the big phone call. I'm waiting for the bigger job, the bigger ministry, the bigger friend. I don't know, bigger, just kept going there. I was going to say bigger wife, but that would have been really bad. So I just stopped right there. Sometimes it's so easy to say, I want to risk for God. I want to go and do whatever he wants me to do. I'm ready. Whenever he tells me to go, I'll go. But in the meantime, he's saying, well, what's right in front of you? What is sitting there? What have you buried? I'm not going to call you over there when you aren't faithful with the one thing that I've entrusted to you for right now. Engage where I've put you, and then I will entrust you with so much more. I love what happens when the master comes back. He says in verse 20, and he who had received, verse 19, now after a long time, the master of these servants came and settled accounts with them. And he who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 talents more, saying, Master, you gave me 5 talents. Here, I've given you 5 more. His master said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. And also he who had the 2 talents came forward, saying, Master, you gave me 2 talents. Here, I've made 2 more. His master said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a little, I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. He also, who had received the 1 talent, came forward. And listen to the bitterness here. Listen to what has happened to this third guy. While he's waiting for the master to return, see how it's changed his attitude and opinion. Verse 24, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, have what's yours. Isn't that amazing? So in the middle of this, he insults the master, being like, listen, I know how you work. You're a cutthroat. You know, you're taking stuff that's not yours. You're a hard man, and I'm afraid of you, so you know what? I hid it in the ground. Here, take it back. I don't want it. Take what's yours. But his master answered him, you wicked and slothful or lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you should have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I could have received what was mine with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10. For to everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness, in that place where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Isn't it amazing to see here that not only is this servant refusing to engage with what he's been given, but it actually changes him. He becomes so angry about what has happened, he's blaming the master for changing him. He's saying like, boy, you made me afraid. I'm afraid of you, and I'm afraid of you. And then it became bitterness, and there's resentment. And how often in our lives is that moment where we are waiting for something bigger, we're waiting for something better, we're waiting for something worthy of our time and talents, and while we're waiting, we don't realize the damage that we're doing. We don't realize our bitterness that's growing. We don't realize how resentful we're becoming towards people in our lives, maybe even towards God. And so in this moment, when the master returns, he's like, man, you could have just put it in the bank. If you weren't going to do it, if you think I'm so hard, just put it in the bank and give me the interest. And he threw him out. Wicked and lazy servant. Engaging right where we are. If you find yourself in that season where you're wondering about the story that you're living in, and you wish it was a different script, and you're waiting for the page to turn, you're waiting for the new chapter to start, you're waiting for the director to come and say, oh, I'm sorry, you've been in the wrong role all along. We've got this role for you. This is who you really are. If you're waiting for that to happen, you're like that servant who's burying the talent, just waiting for life to get better, waiting for something better to come along. The way to live in a better story is not necessarily to go far away. It's not necessarily to quit your job and go pursue your dream of writing Elizabethan poetry on the banks of Paris or whatever. If that's your dream, I'm sorry. I really am sorry. No. That would be great. We need poets. That may not be what makes it a better story for you. A better story begins by engaging with what God has put in your life right now. Engaging with the people, engaging with the place, engaging with the ministry, engaging with your life that God has put you in right now. And not just engaging, but giving your entire heart and soul and life to it, risking, investing, giving everything to it. So then maybe God will come back to you and say, my goodness, well done, I've got this much better thing for you over here. Or you know what? Maybe he won't. And maybe this thing that you think is so worthless and meaningless and so dead is everything you've ever wanted. And it's going to become that over time as God moves and blesses. As you look at your family and you think about your failures and think about the mistakes you've made and you see the distance between your husband or your wife and you see the respect you've lost from your children or you realize you don't really know your neighbors at all and the people that you work with just know that you kind of go to church occasionally. How do you engage now? Engage with your spouse in a new way. Love them for who they are right now. A better story for you starts with a better marriage. And a better marriage just starts with what you do next. It's not necessarily about going to 12 hours of counseling. It's not necessarily about buying that book everyone's talking about. It's not necessarily about sitting through a DVD series, although all those things are helpful. All you can control is what you do next. Engaging in that moment. Engaging with your children. Saying, my goodness, I want a better story for my children as a family. So what is it that I can do as a parent to see them grow up and live a better story with us? What is it that I can call my children to that's bigger than ourselves as a family? I remember reading a book a few years ago that talked about this, and this couple was so moved by the fact that their children were just existing as a family, living the American dream, that they sat down and said, you know what we're going to do? We are going to actually, as a family, build an orphanage in Mexico. And the kids were like, what? Really? And the dad and mom are like, yep, that's what we're doing. Let's do it. So they scrimped and they saved, and it became their mission as a family, and they actually went down to Mexico, and they built a little orphanage for children, and they partnered with an organization, and they were a part of it. And their family, the story of their family is one that's being told all over the world now. We're just a regular family that just got a big dream. And they decided, they didn't even move away. They just did it from right where they were. They just changed their focus as a family. and said, what's our dream as a family? What's my dream for my children? What do I want them to see in us? I mean, if you think about it, if somebody was to watch how you live your life, what story would it be telling them? If somebody watched my day in and day out, what story am I writing? What am I leaving behind? Because it's not about what I think or what I feel that anyone can see. It's just about what I do. It's about my actions. We don't know how many mighty men thought about going to get water, but we certainly know about the three who went and got it. You don't know how many times I've thought about going to the gym, but you could see I haven't gone very often. It's not about that moment that we say, okay, I'm going to do it. It's about the moment that you actually do it. It's not about just deciding that you're going to make changes. It's actually living it out. Maybe for you, it's this year. I wanted to do this message today because we're on the cusp of 2015. And some of you will make resolutions. And many of us will not keep them. But what if our resolution this year was to live in a better story this year? What if our resolution was to live for God this year in a bigger and a better way? That our story would weave into God's story so that when moments like David's happened, we are just, people see our story and they just are like, okay, there's a great God because what you did was ridiculous. That shows me you're willing to do that for God. That impresses me. That moves my heart. What started as your act of heroism ends up being someone else's act of worship. If you feel stuck, if you feel like that third servant, engage, dig up the talent, dust it off, and go for it. This is the only life you're getting to live. I know that's incredibly simple, but there isn't this other life that you have an option to jump to. This is it. A poet of the 60s and 70s said, life is what happens while you're busy making other plans. This is what you've got. Can you engage right now in this moment? You think about your relationship with Jesus this year. You think about your discipleship journey. You think, boy, this year I really want to grow. I feel like I've been stuck in my faith in the same spot for so long. Engage right where you are with who you are. And engage with God where he's made himself available to you. So don't do your devotions because you feel like you should. Read it because you want to know God in a powerful way, because this year you want to be a part of a bigger story. Your heart this year is you say, you know what? I've got this neighbor that I know is hurting. I know they don't know God, and I want to reach them. I need to know more about my Bible as I do that because they're asking me questions. Have you ever had that where someone asks you a question about the Bible that you don't know? Have you ever noticed a difference in your research in that moment from just a Tuesday afternoon when you're just thumbing through? There's an urgency where you're like, oh, I don't know about that. My goodness, when was there a guy who killed 800 with a spear? I got to find that up. I mean, Google's a great thing too, just in case you're wondering. But you look it up there and you find the reference and you're reading it. You read it differently when there's a conversation attached to it, when there's an individual who needs to know. Maybe it's in the area of worship this year. You just want to worship God in freedom and passionately and in truth. Maybe it's you've never given faithfully. You've never tithed because, well, I barely pay my bills as it is. How am I supposed to add another bill to my monthly finances? Maybe this is the year that God writes a story in your life about the year that you started to give faithfully and were obedient to him and watch God supply. That's a great story. That's a story we love to hear. When someone says, you know what, I've actually been obedient in tithing for this last year, and I didn't know how it was going to work, but you know what? God keeps coming through. And then there's story after story after story of how God's come through in a powerful way. Those stories wouldn't be part of your life if you weren't faithful to what God's asked you to do. Do you see how the more faithful we are to what God wants us to do with our lives, the more incredible stories start to happen? Maybe it's serving this year. And it's time for you to engage where you are and say, you know what, I'm not able to teach kids, but I can shake hands at the back door. I'm not able to play an instrument, but I can help you park cars. We have areas to serve all over this church and all over this community. It's time to engage in what God has called us to. The band's actually going to come up here and close us out in a song. And I pray that as we think about 2015, this song could be kind of an anthem for you. Because when we seek to engage God right where we are, that's the start to living in a better story. It may not be as exciting to begin to just live faithfully where God has placed you right now. It may not be as exciting to come home with your big takeaway, gather your family around and be like, kids, I want you to know that I've made a decision. I'm going to engage you in a more realistic and powerful way this year. They're going to be like, what does that even mean, Dad? But I'm telling you, your decision to do that is going to craft an incredible story through your life that will have ramifications and have impact to generations like you cannot believe. You take that step of faithful obedience just in one area and watch the stories that God's going to write through your life. That's the God we serve, a God who wants to use our story.